The next case is 04214, Jeffrey Grube, Catherine Grube, and Lowell Bowie versus Key Bank and Key Corporation. Justice Resnick has recused herself in this case. We're very pleased to have sitting in place of Justice Resnick, Judge Sheila Farmer, who is a judge of the Court of Appeals sitting in the 5th Appellate District. Welcome, Judge Farmer. Yes. Mr. Wilkinson.
Excuse me. May it please the Court, Mr. Chief Justice. I'll reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal. It's ironic in this case, as I stand here for the appellant, that the dispositive point in this appeal is one on which the trial court, both the judge and the jury, and the Court of Appeals agreed, even though I urge reversal here, of the Court of Appeals decision which overruled the trial court. And that dispositive point is there's no evidence in the record of any culpable conduct on the part of Key Bank. The trial judge directed a verdict in favor of Key on the charges of negligent hiring, negligent supervision. The jury entered a verdict in favor of Key Bank on the respondeat superior question. The Court of Appeals judge described the suggestion that there was evidence that Key Bank acted culpably as a lame argument as to which there was no evidence. Clearly, there's evidence in the record that the former employee of Key Bank may have acted culpably. She interviewed a potential loan applicant, some months later resigned from the bank, and thereafter acquired the business that the loan applicant was interested in. And the jury punished the wrongdoer in this case, an award of $50,000 in compensatory damages. And apparently, of the view that the conduct was sufficiently egregious that they further punished the former employee with a punitive damage award of $500,000 approximately. But on the other hand of the culpability coin, on the other side of that coin, as to Key Bank, no evidence of negligent hiring, no evidence of negligent supervision, no evidence of negligent training, no evidence that the bank knew anything about the former employee's misconduct, no evidence that the bank was participated in any way in the misconduct or knew about the misconduct. No evidence even that the bank benefited from the conduct. To the contrary, the evidence is that the bank lost two good customers on account of the misconduct of the former employee. Ohio law has been clear on the point of the duty owed by between debtors and creditors settled law for many years.
You said this in your brief, and I want to hear your strongest argument. Why is the instruction that the plaintiffs wanted here, if you find that the employee was aided in her wrongful interference by her status as loan officer, Key Bank, then you must find for the plaintiffs and against defendant, Key Bank? That conflicts with Bird and Little Miami? That's your contention, right?
It does indeed. I mean, it conflicts with the Little Miami Bird doctrine, which has been the settled law of Ohio for over 100 years. In the cases where intentional torts are committed, unless the business purposes of the employer are being furthered by the intentional misconduct, as might be the case that in the bouncer cases, for example.
Should we be troubled at all by the fact that the loan officer here used her position with Key Bank to obtain confidential information and then use it for her own benefit? Concern from the bank's standpoint, liability standpoint, that she got that information because she was employee of the bank and had this position of, we won't call it fiduciary because I know everybody wants to stay away from that, I guess, but whatever it is, she has that position. Should we be reviewing Bird and Little Miami and maybe perhaps in the context of today's commerce?
Well, I think the answer to that question, Mr. Chief Justice, is that the law works as it stood before the Court of Appeals decision. The wrongdoers are punished. The doctrine of respondeat superior developed because there are clearly circumstances where employers can control the behavior of their employees. They should attend to proper hiring practices, supervision practices, training practices, disciplinary practices, and certainly never actually participate in activities that are designed to harm a
customer. So, counsel, the only way the Court of Appeals standard that basically found that the very employee-employer relationship is sufficient to hold KeyBank liable because of just the activity that was facilitated by the fact this person was an employee, and that's basically what the Court of Appeals is saying here, would only hold true if there was a negligent hiring liability here. In other words, the KeyBank placed her in a position such as she was in with either knowing or should have known that she would act in this manner.
That's exactly right, Justice O'Connor. In fact, the American Law Institute, as it has disavowed Restatement Section 219, 2D, has come to precisely that conclusion, that the focus shouldn't be on aiding or participating. Because if, Justice O'Connor and Mr. Chief Justice, if you were to focus on the proposition that by virtue of her position, a loan officer at a bank has access to confidential information and is thereby aided by her position when she misappropriates a business opportunity of a customer, then you would upset the holding. You would reverse the holdings in Little Miami and in Vrabel and in Lima Railway and in Byrd and all those cases, because certainly in all those cases, the employee was aided somehow in the participation in the commission of the tort by being provided a hatchet by the employer, by being provided with the trappings of the pastor in the Byrd case, and with the authority to conduct counseling for parishioners. That's why the American Law Institute has withdrawn and disavowed 219, just as the appellee, the plaintiff below, has disavowed it in the briefs here. The jury instruction, in this case, if the court were to review that question, it would not be in this case. Because in this case, the jury instruction and the decision below are both based on the disavowed restatement section, 219.2d. And that statement has been disavowed, and the jury instruction specific essentially quotes from 219.2d. And in the Court of Appeals decision at pages 13 and 14, the court specifies the error of the trial court as being failure to follow the disavowed restatement section.
Why shouldn't we draw a distinction, though? I mean, most of the cases that you rely on really involve something I don't think the average person has trouble seeing as going out of the course of the regular course of business. You know, their physical assaults, their sexual assaults, that's easy to follow. But when someone is, when the tort is directly related to their position, they get this confidential information because of their position. They turn down the bank loan because of their position. They misappropriate it because of their position. Why should the responsibility fall on the innocent party to collect against what is usually an uncollectible single employee person versus the bank that could put in controls, could put in ways to guard against that? I mean, that to me, there's a clear distinction between the type of cases you relied on that really involve sort of more physical assaults than the actual job the person is doing that allows them to commit the tort.
I think the basic reason, Justice Stratton, why we should revert to the law as it existed before the Court of Appeals decision below is that the decision below essentially would transform employment into an ultra-hazardous activity. The effort of the appellee and the plaintiff here is to transform the employer-employee relationship into one where there is essentially strict liability for the conduct of the employee, because if you contemplate the scenarios in which employees commit torts, where the rogue employees commit torts, they are inevitably aided somehow by their position when the tort is committed against a customer of the employer.
Well, let me ask it a little differently. If this had been a bank teller, and the bank teller had taken the customer's check and forge the signature and run off with the money, would the bank teller be the only one that customer could go after?
a more difficult question, Justice Stratton, because it is within the scope of responsibility for the bank teller to handle the money.
And why isn't it not within the scope of responsibility of this teller or this employee to allow the loan if they were qualified rather than disallow it and then appropriate? I mean, they're taking information, they're converting it to their own use, the client loses out. Why should the bank be the one that bears the social responsibility rather than the innocent customer? It, just like in the bank teller forging the signature. I have a hard time seeing the distinction between those two scenarios. I easily can distinguish the assault stuff. That's not a problem. But when you actually take your role and you use that role to make a decision that allows you to benefit financially and deprives the customer of that. That's a distinction I'm having a trouble making between the bank teller forging the check.
Well, there are a couple of reasons. One is that in this case, the finding below has been that the conduct was not within the scope of responsibility. The jury was charged on this question. The jury was said, if you find that this woman was acting in the scope of her responsibility, then you find against KeyBank. Secondly, the actions complained of below and that resulted in the damage wasn't the wrongful turndown on the loan application. The action which caused the damage was acquiring the business opportunity, converting, misappropriating the business opportunity.
But wait a second, if you hadn't turned the loan down, then they could have gotten the loan and gotten the business, right?
Possible. Every bank was turning down these applicants. But you're right. You're absolutely right. But every bank was turning down these loan applicants. They couldn't get a loan
anyway. That doesn't necessarily mean KeyBank would have. Did anybody research that issue as to whether they would have qualified under Key standards?
I think that given the fact that the appellee never applied for the loan, never actually submitted an application, that's something that we don't know.
But weren't they told they weren't going to get it, so they didn't go forward with anything further?
The record indicates that the appellees were told that the bank wasn't interested in that business. That's correct. But the key point is that the jury has made a determination in this case. Our record tells us the jury was told, if you find she was acting within the scope, then you find KeyBank liable. And the verdict by the jury was KeyBank is not liable. The jury was alternatively told, if you find that that Sapinsley, the former employee, acted intentionally, then you may also find Key liable if you find that that she was acting in any way, in whole or in part, that furthered or promoted the business of the bank. All of this discussion about the respondeat superior point presumes, however, that there's a duty. The Umbaugh poll case, the Blonde v. Bank One case, established that without more than a debtor-creditor relationship, there is no fiduciary duty. Debtors and creditors without more, not fiduciary. What does the more mean? This court has established in Stone v. Davis and in Walters v. First National Bank what more means in this context. And what it means is that there's a situation, because we don't get to the respondeat superior argument unless we find that there is some sort of fiduciary or special duty. This court has held that in Stone v. Davis and Walters, only in circumstances where the bank as an institution has a reservoir of knowledge that the unsophisticated non-commercial consumer doesn't have, that the non-consumer or that the consumer is relying upon that storehouse of knowledge at the bank, and that the bank acts culpably, as in both the Stone and the Walters cases, by saying to the young man and woman, would you like to, do you want the mortgage life insurance? Yes, but not telling them they have to go out and get it, the bank's not going to. There was a misrepresentation made about the existence of insurance in the Walters case. Absence those kinds of special circumstances, which are in the loan completion, the loan processing stage, not plausible that to say that at the loan application stage and the negotiation of terms stage, that the bank would owe a fiduciary duty not to look out for its interests, but to look out for the customer. This isn't a case that involves that loan processing, loan completion stage, so the duty on which the respondeat superior obligation would be based doesn't even exist in Ohio.
Counsel, doesn't the Court of Appeals somewhat confuse the definition or the practical application of confidentiality in fiduciary. I think there was confidential information that was shared with the bank, but that alone, will that rise to impose a fiduciary relationship?
No, in fact, although the appellee in the trial court made it clear in jury instructions number 1 and number 5 that their case was based on a supposed fiduciary duty, there isn't one. The two cases that the Court of Appeals relied on, Jawarzadeh and the Pig case from out in Oklahoma and Colorado, in neither of those cases was there a finding that there's a fiduciary duty. So if the court were inclined to revisit the question whether there should be one, this isn't the case to do that because in the only cases cited by the appellee, the duty was found to be one that was not fiduciary.
Thank you, Mr. Wilkinson. Mr. DeMarco.
Good morning, Your Honors. I want to begin where Mr. Wilkinson left off with the question of duty. The question here is, when, and this is addressed in Jawarzadeh and Pig and in Dalton, when a customer seeking a loan goes into a bank and by virtue of seeking the loan is forced to divulge the business opportunity for which the customer seeks the loan, are the bank and its officers perfectly free to divulge that information and trade on it? That's the duty question here. He didn't address the bank, he only addressed the employee, but I suspect his answer
Counsel, how did the
be,
bank trade on that information? What did the bank do?
Well, in this situation, the bank didn't trade on the information.
Well, you just,
the employee,
you just, you, right, you said the bank and the employee, are they free to trade on that information? Well, that's not what we have here. We have
right.
an employee self-serving as a result of obtaining this information. How did the bank disservice or impair the client here?
If you find that there is a duty of confidentiality and a duty on the officer not to trade on the information, that's the same as saying that the bank has the duty because the bank only acts through its employees. In this situation, in Jawarzadeh and Pig and all of these cases, they were asking, did the bank have the duty, the limited duty, not to divulge and trade on the information? The mere fact that an employee of the bank does it does not excuse the bank from its duty to protect the information because of the restatement, Section 214.
So you would equate confidentiality and the dissemination of confidential information with the establishment of a fiduciary relationship?
It's not a full-blown fiduciary relationship because in a full-blown fiduciary relationship, and neither was that found in Stone or in Walters, so there's precedent for not finding full-blown fiduciary relationships in this court, but in a full-blown fiduciary relationship, the fiduciary is supposed to subordinate his interests to those of the other person. Here, we're saying it's very limited. It's limited in application. It only applies to the person seeking a loan who has to divulge the information in order to request it. It is limited in application so that it only covers that information which he is forced to disclose, and it only requires, it's like the Hippocratic Oath, it only says, don't do this person any harm with this information. And, as Jawarzadeh says, it's limited in duration because it only operates temporarily until either the opportunity is secured by the person or lost or it's moot or he has somehow made it public. So all of those things feed into the existence of the duty. Now, why does Jawarzadeh say that there is this duty on the bank and by extension its officers? It gives three reasons. First, because you're compelled to give the information even to get in the door and ask for the loan. Second, because this duty is as necessary for banks as it is for potential borrowers. Why? Because the bank depends on the borrower being candid about what you're going to do with the loan. If the borrower suspects that the bank is going to trade on the information or the officer is going to trade on the information, Jaworzyta said that isn't in the interests of the bank. And third, Jaworzyta says this is merely an affirmation, and the Court of Appeals picked up on this, this is merely an affirmation of what already exists in the banking industry and, just as important, what the public expects in the banking industry. You do not expect when you walk into your bank and you say, I want $1 million to buy a painting. And the bank president says, wow, that must be some painting. What is it? Well, I have discovered an unknown Renoir. Now, the bank under those circumstances would not be able to say, okay, give me your art expert's opinion that this is really a Renoir. Let me look at it tonight, come back in, and when you come back in the next morning, say, we don't want to make the loan, but check out our new Renoir. That's not permissible. And if it's not permissible for a bank, it's not permissible for the officer. Remember, Section 214 of the restatement, and this is not a respondeat superior issue. This is an issue of, can you absolve yourself as the bank? Can you absolve yourself of your duty by delegating it to your officers? And Section 214 says, absolutely not. And Section 7.06 of the third restatement draft that they like to quote to you says, absolutely not.
But it's the bank didn't take advantage of any opportunity here, did they?
No, the bank doesn't have to take advantage of the opportunity in order to violate the duty that we're talking about. They can just disclose it to someone else.
The respondeat issue was decided in favor of the bank by the jury.
Well, there are two, we have to.
You keep saying that the bank is acting through the officer, but that question was submitted to a jury and the bank prevailed.
No, that wasn't what was submitted to the jury. The issue of the duty of the bank, whether the bank owed a duty, was disposed of on directed verdict.
I understand okay. that. But the respondeat only issue went to the jury.
Yes, only on the issue of whether or not, take a look at A27 through 29, the verdict form says, did the plaintiffs have a relationship with Sheevy that gave rise to a business opportunity? Yes. Did she intentionally interfere with that? Yes. Did that intentional interference cause that relationship to dissolve or fall apart? Yes. The fourth question was the bank responsible for that? So the issue I'm talking about, the duty issue, was not in front of the jury. That duty issue can be violated merely by divulging the information and using it, whether you're talking about the bank itself, in my example, the bank president buying the Renoir, or the bank officer going out and buying it. It's the same duty. The bank can't absolve itself of that duty under Restatement 214.
So then you have a strict liability standard.
Right.
And the strict liability standard you're extending to non-customers, really. You use the term customer, but as I understand these facts, these were applicants. They were not people who already had a relationship with the bank and then were applying for new money. These mm-hmm. were people that just walked in and said, right. we want to apply. So you go even further in this case if we were to accept your position.
Well, in Stone versus Davis, they hadn't signed the closing papers. They didn't have their loan either. And in that case, the court imposed the duty. If you're going to bring up mortgage insurance, you have to tell them how to get it. It was a very short-term duty, but it was imposed in favor of people who didn't yet have a loan. And you could say that that was a strict liability duty because the court never said how you could avoid that. But there's another thing to remember about Stone that has, there's a common thread here. In Stone, the bank had a policy of always telling customers how they could secure mortgage insurance once they brought up the subject. Here, the bank's policy is very clear. You don't trade on non-public information that you get, and it's potential borrowers as well as existing borrowers. That's what the bank said. If you look at Mr. Kopnisky's testimony at page 12, he says that's a breach of trust to do that. He didn't say that was a breach of trust only for her. That's a breach of the bank's trust. So you could say it's a strict liability duty. I suppose there might be instances where the bank can say, well, we had to divulge it because of some necessity of public safety or something like that. But that's not the case before the court. Here, the only thing that the court needs to decide is, was there, for that limited period of time, a duty not to divulge it and not for the officer not to go out and trade on it. And that comes back to Justice Stratton's point.
Well, counsel, let me ask you. There was a recovery against the wrongdoer here. Mm-hmm. $50,000 is what the jury determined to be fair compensation, and then the punitive, right. 500 and some thousand.
Yes.
Okay. What more is available and why?
What more is available? Well,
Why Key Bank now?
The plaintiffs settled with Ms. Sapensley, who by the time all of this shook out didn't have much of a business left or much of an interest left, that for, I think, somewhere in excess of $30,000. So they didn't get even what the jury thought was compensation for what had happened to them. But what I want to come back to is Justice Stratton's point, which was raised earlier. In the assault cases, it's usually pretty clear. There's no doubt in this case, though, we have an employee who is acting with stealth, with deceit. But she is aided in that by the position that the bank has given to her and the trappings of that position. They've given her an office. They've given her business cards. All of these things say, from the bank to the customer who doesn't know any different, trust her. She is our loan officer. The example that you gave, Justice Stratton, about the bank teller, that's Oakley Building, which is cited by the Court of Appeals, 84 Ohio App 3rd, 539, where the person bringing the deposit in has no reason to know, because the appearance is created, this is the cashier that takes my deposit, no reason to know that the cashier was going to embezzle. That's what happened. The bank, the savings and loan there, was held liable. Now,
isn't that totally different from what we have here because of the procedures that are in place to discover in the audits and in the industry itself to discover embezzlement or even the simple act of embezzling from one checking account by a teller? You have signature verifications. You have checks and balances in place. And yes, the bank is liable under those situations because of the status of the industry and the checks and balances, et cetera. Here, you've got a discretionary employee, an employee that is employed to exercise discretion within standards that are approved by the bank. And that's the authority in which she's vested. She's not vested with the authority to abscond with that information and use it for self-dealing. Under any scenario, would the bank say that would be part of her job, part of the trust that we've placed in her to be self-dealing?
But remember, everything she did in this circumstance to scuttle this deal, and this deal was scuttled when...
Well, they weren't credible. They weren't worthy credit recipients, according to the record, with sufficient number of other banks had turned them down.
Actually, that needs to be clarified. They had... One of those banks was contacted by the lawyer for one of them, not the lawyer for the other. There were two partners here. That lawyer didn't send any information that was substantive to Star Bank and get a formal denial or anything like that. People's Bank in Northern Kentucky doesn't do commercial loans. That's why they were turned down. So as far as what she did to pull this off, she met with the plaintiffs at the bank. She gathered their information. She processed the information. She reviewed it in front of them, said, looks like you found the goose who laid the golden egg. She contacted Sheevy. She asked them for more information. They sent their draft purchase agreement at her request. She processed that information. She made the turndown decision. So far, she hasn't stepped one millimeter outside the authority that the bank gave to her. Now, the way that Key approaches this is to say, no, it's all about motivation and purpose. Is the employee's purpose to benefit the employer? And Chief Justice Moyer asked at the outset, should we be reviewing Little Miami and in light of modern events? Well, we all sit at our desk and we get emails flooding to us. I don't want to be facile about arguing, but in the course of a day, you are serving and not serving your employer. But I don't think we have to completely change what this court has done over the years, Chief Justice Moyer, because this court has been on target. When you read from Little Miami onto Young, and Stranahan. And then what Nelson says, which is that Stranahan is the law, even though in Stranahan, poisoning the milk wasn't serving the employer's benefit, it was actually intended to hurt the employer. And then you bring it forward in all of those cases, and you set aside the assault cases, but you bring it forward to Cairns versus Porter Paint. And the very same argument was made in Cairns, that you have to go by purpose. The sexual harassment had to have been for the benefit of the employer. And this court said, no, it's the appearance of authority that was created. They put that person, that supervisor, in the position to harass, that the employer has to accept responsibility for that. Now, they cite to the third restatement, and I think it's a tentative draft, but it's very interesting because the third restatement is saying that where this court was all along, which was to also analyze, did the employer create the appearance of authority in the employee such that it should be bound even by intentional conduct, the third restatement says when the third party reasonably believes that the agent or other actor has the authority to act on behalf of the principal and that belief is traceable to the manifestations by the principal, they act with apparent authority. It goes on to say that the agent's motivation is immaterial to the legal consequences that the agent's actions carry for the principal. Likewise, the fact that the agent's conduct is not in fact beneficial to the principal does not shield the principal from legal consequences. That's what they cite. That's the new restatements. That's that direction that the restatement is heading in. And I submit to you that this court has been heading in since 1869. But also the restatement says this about position, because it goes back to what the Court of Appeals said. Did they place them in the position? It says at 1.03, which is referred to in the same section, if the principal places a person in a position or office with specific functions or responsibilities from which third parties will infer that the principal assents to acts by the person requisite to fulfilling the specific functions and responsibilities, the principal has manifested such consent to third parties.
And it says
the setting is what you're looking at. Here we're looking at the setting.
Well, isn't that when the agent is acting with the cloak of authority and the trappings of authority, and they're facilitating something they're supposed to be facilitating, their superior will be held liable. Not when they're committing an intentional breach.
Actually, what I read to you, because it's focusing on whether motivation is any longer the deciding factor and whether the benefit to the employer is the deciding factor. It's what they cited.
Well, you can have all kinds of motivation. It's not necessarily motivation to do wrong. It may be motivation to be negligent, or you know, the act itself could be negligent and not rise to the level that we have here. At that point, they're saying, yes, the superior will be held liable.
But to come back to Justice Stratton's point, the appearance created for a third party who knows nothing about the motivations, the appearance created is that this person is sitting in her office taking my information, and she appears to be dealing with it in a regular way, in the usual course of business. That third party doesn't know any difference. And the original phrase used, I think, by Justice Stratton, where should the economic burden fall? It has to fall on the bank, which, after all, put her in that office and invited everyone in to deal with her as a loan officer. It has to have the responsibility. When these individuals come in who've never met her before, it has to have the responsibility. These people can't be held to the responsibility of seeing through her motivations. They have to be able to judge the appearance created by the bank. And in this situation, there was no doubt the bank created the appearance. Trust this woman. We do.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. DeMarco. Mr. Wilkinson, you've saved about 40 seconds of your time.
This court should not, at this point in the development of Ohio law, now begin to distinguish between violent and nonviolent rogue employees. Clearly, there are circumstances where a rogue employee could, for example, in Ms. Sapinsley's case, she could have taken information from credit files and used them to embarrass a former spouse. She could have used them to try to ruin an enemy's job employment opportunities. All outside the scope of responsibility, all rogue activities, all firing offenses at KeyBank and other banks. The court also needs to distinguish between the time. The appellee here says that there's a high fiduciary duty at the beginning of the relationship when we're negotiating with each other whether we'll do business, and for that moment of time, it's fiduciary, and then the duty drops. In fact, this court has said in Stone v. Davis and Walters, it's the opposite. When we're negotiating terms and deciding whether to do business, we're at arm's length. In Stone v. Davis, after the commitment to the loan is made and we're closing it, at that point are the only exceptions that have been made to the proposition that without more, the relationship of debtor and creditor is not a fiduciary one. The law worked in this case. This is not an epidemic. The court below said this is a rare case, one of first impression. This is not a situation where we have a crisis crying out for a remedy. This is an isolated case. It made bad law below, and that decision should be reversed and the trial court's decision and the jury verdict reinstated. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wilkinson. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.